So it kind of occurred to me over the last few years. I was way too late. I started reading a book on how to parent your kids. I mean, it was like both of them were already here, and we were kind of already into things. And I was like, hey, you know, there's this book that my dad had given me a long time ago. And so I started perusing through it. And one of the things it said was interesting because I feel like it sort of nailed me between the eyes. It talked about the, and this is not childhood rearing philosophy, I'm telling you from us, I'm just saying what this book said. And it talked about, you know, that you do damage to a child if you tell them that they are intelligent or smart or a natural athlete or they're just really good at something. They said instead praise the effort involved in that. So instead of being like, Cliff, you're so smart, be like, you are a great hard worker on that vocabulary quiz. Or however, that's probably a smoother way to say it than that. But I was like, wow, isn't it? And they said, because what happens to that young child is that when they grow up, as they grow up, because they think that, because they believe that they're intelligent, because they believe they're a great athlete, because they believe that things should come easy to them based on who they already are, that when something's truly challenging, among some of these children, they just pull back. If it's not automatically, if I'm not automatically good at it, I'm like, I'm not so much. You know, so you see it even in current examples, such as this construction project. We're like, oh, I can hold that for you, but don't ask me to put that screw in because I'm not sure if it's going to be the best of anyone here. You know, and I think about sports and things like that. You know, like growing up, I feel like I picked up pretty quickly things, but then I would get to a sport like golf. And that's not really like a natural athlete sport. That's more like everything you've ever learned in every other sport, you need to throw away quickly because you're going to start to do something else that you have to learn. And so, but I wasn't good at golf. And so then I would like take it out on the clubs and like the cart and everyone around me would be like, why aren't I automatically good at this? You know, like it was really frustrating. I'd be like, I should be able to do this. I can do this. Why can't I do this? And it's just funny how I think in my own life, I'm not saying that that's necessarily airtight childhood thinking, but I can say with me, I think it's real. Because growing up, I was very affirmed, almost too much probably, I think, you know, just kind of an unhealthy level of confidence as a young man, I think. But it was kind of that, carrying that around, like, you know, you're good, and so then for me, if a real challenge came, I didn't want to do it because obviously I should be able to win or just do it well. So I think this is part inside of us. It's like, I can do it, and if I can't do it, I'm going to avoid it. At least that's a peek into me. But there's been a few moments in my life where not only could I not do it well, I couldn't do anything about what was happening. I couldn't stop it. I couldn't help it. I couldn't save them. I couldn't heal her. I just couldn't stop what was happening. And that's a helpless feeling. When I look, I said this a little bit in the first service about growing up, my mom battled a lot of health issues, and from a very early age, I just remember thinking of her and trying to take care of her and help her in that way, and being so frustrated that I couldn't stop what was going on. I couldn't help her. I couldn't take away her sickness. I could just bring her warm, she liked like warm cups of water, like just, like, you sure you don't want some coffee or tea in there or something, you know, just no warm water, because she was dealing with some stuff where that was good. And so I would bring that to her, and I'd make sure she was covered with a blanket and stuff. My sisters and I would always try and care for her, but I remember at a very young age being like, nothing I'm doing is really taking care of her pain. It's just sort of making her more comfortable. I can't stop this. When Angela and I first got married, we were setting up our apartment after our honeymoon, and she was just putting dishes away and kind of working in the kitchen, and something about that process made it so painful for her to walk that she was basically ordered to not walk for like 10 days and just to lay low because they said she had stress fractures in both of her feet and it was really bad. And so they gave her those boots where the bottom is rounded. I don't know if that's some variation of a clog or something, I don't know. But so we had this white, really high-end, classy, white linoleum floor in this rental apartment in Pennsylvania. And so I would come home from work and be like, okay, babe, you got to stay on the couch today. And she's like, okay, I will. And I would come home, and these black boots would scuff the floor if you walked on them. And so I could come home and see how good she did at not walking by all the scuff marks I could count on the floor. So there's accountability in that. Also, she didn't want to wear the shoes that they told her to wear. So, you know, they kind of ordered her into the, like, a different catalog of shoes, like the sort of hospital grade, you know, just not exactly fashionable shoes, just maybe, I don't know, Keds? Were they Keds? Is that a thing anymore? Keds? I don't know. It's not a thing. Okay. But there's Velcro involved and like surgical grade, you know, very comfortable orthotic shoes. But she would choose to wear shoes that had high heels and straps and all this other fancy stuff. And I called them her naughty shoes. I'm like, you can't wear these naughty shoes. We'd get into these huge fights because she would wear these naughty shoes. She was literally suffering for her fashion sense. And I'm like, you come home from this party that we're at with these bad shoes and then you can't walk for 2 days. And so we got into all these arguments, but I couldn't stop it. I couldn't control it. Even if she was wearing the white Velcro nurse edition Keds or whatever they were, you know, it wouldn't really help. I couldn't take it away. I couldn't stop that pain. I couldn't reach in and heal her feet. After a while, we wanted to have kids. You know, it kind of seemed like a thing that you do, and we wanted to, and we started down that journey, and went to every doctor that kind of helps in that area, and it just wasn't happening, and there was nothing I could do to change it. I couldn't. We were at a dead end. Over the last few years, just issues that we walked through, even in our marriage, even things that brought us even here, there were moments where I was like, I can't. There's nothing I can do right now. Like, this is kind of out of my hands. I can't fix this. Have you ever reached that point with someone or with a loved one or in your own life where you just reach the end of what you can possibly do and you have that moment of like, there's nothing else I could say. I have to give this to someone else. I have to hand this over to God. I have to say, Jesus, will you please do it? I can't do anymore. I've reached the end of myself in caring for this person and dealing with this situation. You teeter kind of on that brink of hopelessness there, don't you? You're kind of holding on to that last shred like, well, maybe this can go away. But you start to almost accept the reality that it's not. Have you ever been in that place? I'm horribly guilty of that, where I kind of accept the conditions that we're in. And I'm like, well, let's just plot our lives out based on this problem being there forever. I wish I had more faith in those moments. But unfortunately, I find myself when people are praying for healing or praying for help, I'm like, okay, well, yeah, thanks for that. I appreciate that. But we're kind of dealing with the reality of the healing not coming. And I know that there's a cynical side of me that's kind of risen up over the last few years. But there have been those moments of desperation where I literally cry out and I say, God, I can't help her. I can't stop this. I can't save this person. I can't do it. But I know you can. I know you can, Jesus. So we're going to look at a story this morning about a father who was in that spot. Not that his son was wearing naughty shoes, as far as we know. It's not in the text. It's possible, I guess. But we have a father and a son. It's in Mark chapter 9. If you want to turn there, that would be great. If not, that's fine. I'm going to read it. Just to set a little bit of the context here, Jesus has just, in the beginning of Mark 9, taken Peter, James, and John up to the top of the mountain, and Jesus was what's called transfigured. He had a transfiguration, meaning that for a moment, his human body that he took on, he was able to sort of show the disciples the glory of his divinity, just his godlike look. So they saw his glory, and they saw Moses, and they saw Elijah, and it was just this powerful, powerful moment. So he chose Peter, James, and John to go up and do this. So they literally had a spiritual mountaintop experience with Jesus, actually literally on the mountaintop. And then they were coming back down from the mountain to the passage that we're heading into this morning. But you know what I find a little bit interesting that kind of sets a little bit of the mood of the crowd that Jesus returns to? Is that he chose the inner circle disciples. He chose 3 of the 12. There were 9 others that weren't invited on this special field trip. There were 9 others that didn't get to go up the mountain. And I'm just talking about the sort of obscure disciples like James the Less or Judas, not Iscariot. You know, but there's some pretty big hitters in there that did not get that invitation. Matthew, who wrote the book of Matthew, he wrote scripture. He was left at the bottom of the mountain with this crowd. So I wonder among the 12 what might have been going through their minds as Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up to show them his glory and then comes back down. I don't know how you're wired, but if I'm left out of a moment like that, I kind of want to be like, oh, I'll show him that he chose the wrong 3. I should have been the fourth in that group. It would have been more symmetrical. So they come down and Jesus returns and they're in a crowd. It's the nine plus a group that featured scribes, and it featured a lot of people looking to be healed and then just people who wanted to see Jesus. So it's Mark chapter 9. That's kind of where we are, verse 14. And when they, this being Jesus, Peter, James, and John, came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood, and it has often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him." Now listen to this very carefully. "But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of the people said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but by prayer." Now, what's interesting here, one of the moments we have to keep in mind is that when Jesus was up on the mountain, the nine are down here, the scribes are there. Now, they're mentioned many times in the New Testament. Usually it's scribes and Pharisees that are mentioned, but here's just scribes. These were religious leaders. They were given to recopying the text. They were also given to sort of a really kind of pious lifestyle, tended towards the rigid legalism of the day. They had some beliefs about people. We've talked about this before a little bit, where if somebody was sick, if somebody had an illness, it was taught in these religious circles that you were sick because there was sin in your life. You were sick because there was sin in your parents' life. And in fact, if you were born with an illness or if you were given some really bad sickness as a child, they believed that there was sin in your parents' life. And so they really were not able to set, that's kind of how they dealt with suffering. They're like, well, a good God couldn't allow suffering unless we've done something to deserve it. So they really tied sin and suffering together. And so if someone was in that culture and had some sort of an illness, they believed that it was because that there was some sin in their life, something that they were doing to displease God. So that's a bit of that background. And then also, a few chapters ago in Mark 6, Jesus looked at his 12 disciples and sent them out on a mission, on a missions trip, basically. And when they went out as 12, they went out two by two, and he sent them out. And while they were out there, they did two things. They were able to, with the power of God, they were able to heal the sick, and they were able to cast out demons. That's what they did on this missions trip. And they had success, and they were very excited. They're like, wow, you know, I saw, one of them said, Jesus said, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven," meaning like what they had done had really had an impact on the spiritual world. So they just had this powerful moment just a little while before this passage comes. So they're standing in this crowd. This father brings this son up to them, and here are the nine, already maybe a little bit ruffled because they're not with the three up on top of the mountain, and they're like, hey, we can take care of this. We know how to do this. We can get this boy well. Guys, let's do it. And so they tried. They tried to cast this demon out. They tried to heal this boy, and it wasn't happening. And somewhere in that process, whether the scribes, since they were arguing, also it suggests in the passage and in the original language that there was arguing and a bit of almost like mockery, like they were embarrassed that they weren't able to do it. They tried to do it, and it didn't happen, and you have this whole crowd of Jesus' biggest critics around them. Now they're mocking them. Now they're talking to them. And a big argument arose in this moment. And Jesus comes down with Peter, James, and John. He walks into this chaotic scene. And what I love is that Jesus hops right in verse 16. He asks the crowd, "What are you arguing about with them?" I love this picture because, you know, the disciples, most of the disciples were under the age of 20. They were going through the discipleship process with Jesus, and he's teaching them, and he's, you know, obviously Jesus rebukes them, and he really teaches them and shows them ways, but he also protects them and loves them and is leading them. So in this moment, you know, here's these scribes that are older, that are bringing the heat and embarrassing them and really, like, kind of giving them a hard time, and the text seems to paint a picture where Jesus steps in front of his nine and says, "What are we arguing about? What's this all about?" What I love is there's no answer. It's kind of like when the biggest guy in the room comes and stands between the two kids that are kind of picking on each other. And he stands between and says, what's going on here?
Nothing. We're good. Nothing's happening. Your little brother is just fine now. So, and then they run away.
It's like when the more powerful personality, the more powerful presence arrives, those things tend to sort of recede into the background, and Jesus stands between them. But what does pierce the silence of this moment is this desperate father with an urgent need, a heartbroken dad who's got a child that has been sick for a long time and dangerously sick, scary sick. Verse 17, and someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whatever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." There's a couple parallel passages here that go along with this. And one of the parallel passages says when the man came before Jesus, that he kneeled down before Jesus. As a sign of submission and surrender, he kneeled before him and made his request. Another passage tells us that when he says that my son has this condition, he says that it's his only child. So here's a man who comes before Jesus, desperate, heartbroken, kneeling before him to ask him to heal his only child. This story is really hard for me to tell because this is like a scary scenario for a parent. Especially when it's developed in the sense that he has kind of an epileptic illness with deafness and not being able to speak being caused by an evil spirit. This is a physical and a spiritual attack on a small boy. What do you do with that as a parent? Whenever it sees him, it throws him down. He foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. And Jesus answered them, "Oh, faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." Now, the other four times that he uses that word generation or faithless generation, typically he's turning to the crowd around him, not rebuking his disciples, but the door is open that it could be both his disciples that didn't have enough faith in him to do it and also the crowd that didn't believe that he was able to do it. Either way, Jesus is not happy with what was done here in this situation, and he scolds them. Verse 20, and they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw Jesus, immediately it convulsed the boy and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood." Now, Jesus knows everything. Jesus is God. Jesus did not need to know how long this has happened. But have you ever had that doctor? Not the guy that's trying to impress you with his five-syllable words and diagnoses that you don't understand, but the guy who sets aside his clipboard and sits down in the bed next to you and just says, "Hey, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Tell me how you're feeling. Like, I know what's written on the chart, and I know what everyone's telling me you have, and I think I know what you've got, but talk to me about how you feel. How long has this been going on? How long has this been happening?" The doctor who's compassionate and has a bedside manner that makes you feel free to share with him, like you're not a number in a system, but that you're a person with a story that he wants to help. Jesus in this moment says to him, "How long has this been happening?" In doing this, he's also reminding the father of this incredible journey. He's bringing the whole story to light. And as the dad recounts, it's from childhood. Boy, that word for child means infancy, even toddler age. This came on him when he was a baby. That's how long this has been afflicting this little boy. And he explains the condition further. Jesus invites him to explain it, and he does. He says, from childhood. And it's often cast him into a fire and into water to destroy him. So this guy is, basically, if your child has this kind of condition, are you not with them round the clock? If you know that whatever is hurting your child is trying to kill him repeatedly, that if there's fire around, you've got to watch little Billy because, you know, that thing that's that spirit that's in him may try and throw him and burn him, or may try to drown him near the lake. So your entire life for this father is wrapped up in protecting your son from the time he was a tiny baby. You will see just how much this father owns this sickness and this illness, just how much he's suffering with the son, and how he asked Jesus to help them. He says, from childhood, it's often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. And then the father turns to Jesus and says, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. First, I want to look at the first part. But if you can do anything. Your disciples couldn't do anything. There were other exorcists at that time throughout the countryside. Acts 19 talks about the seven sons of Sceva that went around and did that. So this is not that uncommon to have someone who says they can help. So a desperate father is going to take their kid to wherever clinic, whatever place is going to help them. So he's tried everything at this point. And he's saying to him, if you can do anything, your disciples couldn't. These nine that were down here just failed. So if they're representative of you, I'm not so sure, but if you can do something, will you please just have compassion on us and help us? He doesn't say, have compassion on my boy and please help my boy. He says, us. This father is completely in this with his son. He says, you're going to have compassion not only on my son, but on me because I love my son. It's amazing how the father has tied himself to the fate and to the plight and the suffering of his child. And then cries out to Jesus and says, will you help both of us? It's a powerful picture, isn't it? How often do I pray and say, God, will you help her? God, will you help him? God, will you take care of that? How often am I so in a situation and love someone so much that I say, God, will you help us? Help us because my heart is as broken as it can be. If you can do anything. If you can. If you can. He has reached that point that we talked about in the beginning. He's getting down to the last few strands of hope he has left. He's reached full desperation. If you can do anything, please help us. And then Jesus' response highlights it. Jesus says, if you can. If I can, are you saying if? You don't think I have the power to do this? You don't think I have the ability to do this? You're saying if I can, if I'm able to. Now, the question is not ability with God. The question is will. It's not if I can, it's will I, not can I. But he says, if I can, all things are possible for one who believes. Now, that's not some phrase to just say, well, if you just believe in anything, anything will happen. It's saying it's the object of belief. It's object of faith. It's like all things are possible if you believe in the one who can do all things. It's not all things are possible if you just believe that cool things can happen to cool people. It's not that. It's saying the object of your belief, the object of your faith has to be grounded in the only one who can do the impossible. And when you reach that point of faith and say, I believe that you can and I believe that you will heal my son. That's where he was ushering this dad, ushering him to a place where you say, do you believe that I can do it? Because if you believe I can do it, I'm going to show you that I can do it. And I love the dad's answer. Because that is an incredible place to be because it's a vulnerable place. It's hard to pray that way sometimes. You know, it's like we're praying for someone. It's like, God, I know you can heal them. I know you have the ability to. I'm asking you to do it. I'm asking you. I know you can. I pray that you will. And sometimes, although I don't say it out loud, sometimes I get to the point where I've given up hope that he will, which sort of bleeds into can. I get to that point where I just accept that it's not going to happen, and I stop believing that it can. And I stop believing that it will. And then God does the miraculous, and you're like, man, thank you, God. And I'm really feeling like you did it in spite of me, not because of my faith. You did it because I was faithless, and you were faithful. So here he is at this moment, and Jesus says, if I can, anything's possible for him who believes. And the man says to him, such an honest confession. Immediately, the father of the child cried out and said, I believe. Help my unbelief. He cried out. Now remember, this is a crowd. There's 9 disciples that were just confused and hurt and mad. And there's the scribes that are also there. And they were grilling the disciples. And then there's this whole crowd of other people that were sick and other people that were just there to see him. And so it says the man cried out. In the Greek, in the original, this is a loud, piercing wail. It's a shriek. It's loaded with emotion. It's loaded with fear. It's loaded with heartbreak. And he cried out, I believe, in a sense where it's just going to bellow out through the entire crowd. Everyone's going to hear this and draw closer to this guy who just had to say, I do believe, but help my unbelief. I believe, but you know what? I've got fear. I've got doubt. I've got trust issues. I'm not sure. If you see the journey we've been on, it's so hard for me to believe that this is ever going to end. I want to believe that you can do it. Help me. Help me to believe. I struggle with doubt. I struggle with cynicism. I struggle being skeptical. I struggle just flat out being bitter. I love that vulnerability when he says, just help me with my unbelief. I'm not where I need to be. Which is amazing because you think this guy's at the part of his life where he will say anything to get this done. He will say whatever it takes. Whatever you want to hear me say, what do I need to say to get this to happen? Have you ever said that to someone? Okay, what do you need to hear me say so that you'll deliver this on time? What are the magic words here? What do you need to hear from me? He doesn't say that. In fact, he says something that could have driven Jesus away. I believe, but help me in my, I'm not all the way there, I admit that. Help me in my unbelief. Help me in my struggle. Meet me in this place. Verse 25, and when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you to come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of the crowd said, he's dead. I love this, that Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he stood up. Now, we don't have any more about the response or the reaction or anything like that, but put yourself in the father's shoes. What do you do in that moment? The unthinkable has just happened. Your son has been set free. He's standing. Maybe he's speaking. We know that there's a sound that came out of him in that passage out of the sun. But now he's standing up and he's walking and he's not being thrown to the ground. He's not being thrown in the fire. He's not being drowned. It's amazing because you think about this story and I think about the difference between the enemy and Jesus. Because John 10:10 says the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And this little boy has lived that life. Destroy, 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 steal his childhood, kill, who knows where the rest of the family even is, but trying to literally destroy him through fire and drowning and torture and pain. But Jesus finishes that verse by saying, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come that you may have life and have it abundantly. He gave this little boy who was under the oppression of the evil one and sick and all of the things he was going through, and he set him free, and now he raised him up, and he arose, and he walks out. Wouldn't you love to know what that kid did with his life? Wouldn't you love to know what a story he has to tell? I couldn't talk. I couldn't hear. My childhood was not typical in any positive. If he stood up and shared his testimony, we'd all be like, that's unbelievable. But Jesus set me free from the oppression that was on me. And what I love about this story is it's actually my story. Because I couldn't save myself. I was helpless. I was lost. The Bible says I was a prisoner to sin, that I was blind, that in and of myself, I could not save myself. I could not help myself. I could not possibly reach God no matter what I did. And it took Jesus Christ bending down to this earth, coming to this earth and dying on a cross. And then he ushered me into a new life through his death on the cross. That story is my story. Now, the details are a little bit different. But I was brought from a helpless state to one where I now have life and have it abundantly and have it freely. You look at the story of Lazarus. He was dead and Jesus raised him back to life and sent him out to go tell his story. It's a powerful picture of what God does in our lives. And I think about this story and I think as we walk through this, we think there's so many things that I cannot do. So many things I cannot do. And this building project and other things in my life have brought that so painfully to the surface. Just moments where it's like, if you hand me this, I'm going to sit there and be like, I don't know what to do. Not because I was told the wrong thing as a kid, but because now I've just matured to the point where I just have zero ability in that area. So that's just, the ship has sailed on all of that for me. But I think about that. I think there's so many things I can't do in a physical sense, so many things I can't do just in normal living. But then there's also things I can't do in a deeper way. I cannot save anyone. I can get up here and I can pour my heart out and I can prepare for days and weeks and every word is crafted and everything's ready, but I cannot persuade anyone to give their life to Jesus. I can't. The Spirit of God is the only one who can usher someone to himself. And what's incredible is if you think about your life, you think about your journey, there are 7 billion people alive today. 7 billion, that's a lot. There's a lot of things you could be doing this morning other than this. And yet, for some reason, God in his sovereignty and his plan for your life, he put you in these chairs on this morning, in this room, on this day. Because when we hear this, when we hear about the gospel of Jesus, when we understand that we were heading in the wrong direction, that apart from Jesus, we were under the control of the enemy, and we were heading to an eternity apart from God in a place called hell. And until God intervened and Jesus came and died for us, he gave us a new path and a new way. But that way, here's what's incredible. Here's what's amazing about all this. That moment right there where you go from death to life, where you give your life to Jesus, that is not the end. That is just the beginning. If you view your journey to give your life to Jesus and say, well, I'm a Christian now, so I'm going to heaven when I die. If that's how you view it and that's where you end, that's like saying all the hard work of raising my child is done when I give birth. Because the pregnancy's over. Now the baby's here. Now it's easy street. Or viewing the relationship work you did as, well, now we got married, so we've arrived. The work is over, baby. Now we're together all the time. It's just going to be glorious. And ours is glorious. Very little work. On my part, whatever makes you look better than me, I don't know, just apply that. But you know what I mean? In every other area, we see it as these momentous moments are just the beginning of a longer journey. And yet somehow with giving our lives to Jesus, we see it as, well, if we just do this moment, then we're all set and that's it. But that's not it. That's not life. That's not life at all. The invitation that Jesus offers us is nothing short of a transformed life. It's a purpose. It's living for something greater than yourself. It's being a part of a community of believers that has the same goal. It's being known and loved by God. It's knowing that out of 7 billion people, he chose you. He chose you. He chose me. Maybe you're a better choice than I am. I know that already. I still can't believe God chose to give me grace and give me life and give me salvation and give me a life beyond my imagination. I'm like, I feel like you maybe didn't know what I was capable of. I mean, have you ever had that honest talk with yourself where you're like, if you knew all the pages, all the rooms in my heart, God, how could you have saved me? I'm so far from you. And yet by his grace and by his love, he chose to save us and give us a new life and a new heart. What I love is that when we follow Jesus, all the things I say that I can't do, he can. I can't save someone, but Jesus can. I can't make more people go to church to hear about Jesus, but Jesus can. I can't heal anyone's illnesses, but Jesus can. I can't repair a broken marriage, but I promise you Jesus can. I can't solve the addiction that you're battling, but I know the one who can. We serve a God where nothing is impossible. Impossible is just a word we try to put on something we can't explain and we can't accomplish. I can't, but Jesus can. I made it through that story without breaking down, which was hard because you talk about little kids and you have little kids, and that's really hard to do. The band's going to come up here and close our time, but I just want you to think about that just for a moment and think, because we're kind of in different camps. We're in different seasons on this journey. We're all on a journey. We all have different stories, and I think about, for some of you, it's that initial step. It's that moment where we recognize, I can't save myself. I can't do this on my own. I've come to the end of myself, and I need Jesus. I need a Savior, and that's your moment to come before him and say, Jesus, do for me what I can't do for myself. Will you save me and give me new life? I want to follow you with my life. Others of you may be at the point where you say, well, I feel like I did that once. I was like 12 or 13, and it was the campfire was really hot, and I was tired, it was a long week, and I did that. I think I meant it, but I haven't really changed much in my life. I kind of felt like that was enough. Read some passages in the book of James, especially chapter 2, and talk about what it looks like to actually follow Jesus with your life actively, to put your faith into practice. It means you walk with him. It means you follow him all the days of your life. If that's you today, Jesus can rescue you from that dead religion you're hanging on to. He wants to set you free from that because it's not giving you life. It's giving you false hope. And then for others, boy, there's a life that God is drawing you into. He's saying, will you surrender to me? Maybe there's something in your life you're like, boy, you know, I feel like I'm following Jesus with my life and I want more, but there's something that you're holding back. There's something you've not given back to him. Isn't it amazing how no matter where we're at, there's always something more we can do? There's always something more we can do. Even as we rest in the identity that we have in Jesus, even as we rest, it's like I rest in the fact that I'm loved and that I'm married, but there's always something I need to change and fix because I know I keep making mistakes. So I rest in that identity even as I'm seeking to be more. So for each of us, I pray that our passion for Jesus would deepen, that we would fix our eyes on the one who can do anything even as we recognize all that we cannot do. So let's pray together, and we're going to sing one last song. Our song we're singing at the end is Cornerstone. And it just talks about who is our anchor, who is our hope, and his name is Jesus. If anything, questions came to mind, or you want to talk, or you want to pray, or anything like that, I'll be down front. Actually, no, I won't be down front. I'll be by the back doors there, shaking hands and stuff. And if you want to pray or talk about it, please find me, and we'll do that. Pastor Holdridge here in the front row, why don't you raise your hand? He would love to talk to you as well. And you'll be up front. Is that okay? Kind of up here. He'll be up front. I'll be in the back. But we'd love to talk to you some more. And we're excited for the afternoon. Thank you guys so much for coming and worshiping with us. We really, as a church, love Jesus and just want to be a part of what he has in store for this area. And very grateful for you being here. Will you pray with me and let's worship him and go eat some delicious food. God, we love you so much. And I thank you for this morning. I thank you for this time that we've had together. I pray now as we sing one last song, I pray, God, that we would sing a little louder this morning, recognizing that even though there's so many things that I can't do, you can do anything. So God, we lay our lives at your feet this morning and ask you to do something powerful, to do something amazing, even in Fulton, even in Oswego, even in Hannibal, even in central New York. God, you have got something so great in store for this area. We want to be a part of your kingdom advancing. We want to be a part of seeing something break out in this area that cannot be explained or understood. We just need to step back and watch you do the impossible. Thank you for calling us to this season, to this time, and to this moment. I'm so humbled to be a part of it. God, thank you for leading us through these days. It's in the powerful, transformational name of Jesus Christ that we ask it. Amen.